During the years of his training, he enjoyed many opportunities of noting the good qualities, the fidelity, the devotion, often the nobility of soul, of those Hindu princes whom, because they were followers of Brahma, his Muslim courtiers devoted mentally to eternal torments. He noted that these men, and men who thought like them, constituted the vast majority of his subjects. He noted further of many of them, and those the most trustworthy, that though they had apparently much to gain from a worldly point of view by embracing the religion of the court, they held fast to their own. His reflective mind, therefore, was unwilling from the outset to accept the theory that because he, the conqueror, the ruler, happened to be born a Mohammedan, therefore Mohammedanism was true for all mankind. Gradually his thoughts found words in the utterance, "Why should I claim to guide men before I myself am guided?" And, as he listened to other doctrines and other creeds, his honest doubts became confirmed, and noting daily the bitter narrowness of sectarianism, no matter of what form of religion, he became more and more wedded to the principle of toleration for all. "The son of a fugitive emperor," says Dr. Emil Schmidt, "born in the desert, brought up in nominal confinement, he had known the bitter side of life from his youth up. Fortune had given him a powerful frame, which he trained to support the extremities of exertion. Physical exercise was, with him, a passion. He was devoted to the chase, and especially to the fierce excitement of catching the wild horse or elephant, or slaying the dangerous tiger. On one occasion, when it was necessary to dissuade the Raja of Jodhpur to abandon his intention of forcing the widow of his deceased son to mount the funeral pyre, Akbar rode 220 miles in 2 days. In battle he displayed the utmost bravery. He led his troops in person during the dangerous part of a campaign, leaving to his generals the lighter task of finishing the war. In every victory he displayed humanity to the conquered and decisively opposed any exhibition of cruelty. Free from all those prejudices which separate society and create dissension, tolerant to men of other beliefs, impartial to men of other races, whether Hindu or Dravidian, he was a man obviously marked out to weld the conflicting elements of his kingdom into a strong and prosperous whole. In all seriousness he devoted himself to the work of peace. Moderate in all pleasures, needing but little sleep, and accustomed to divide his time with the utmost accuracy, he found leisure to devote himself to science and art after the completion of his state duties. The famous personages and scholars who adorned the capital he had built for himself at Fatehpur Sikri were at the same time his friends. Every Thursday evening a circle of these was collected for intellectual conversation and philosophical discussion. His closest friends were two highly talented brothers, Faizi and Abul Fazl, the sons of a learned freethinker. The elder of these was a famous scholar in Hindu literature. With his help and under his direction, Akbar had the most important of the Sanskrit works translated into Persian. Fazl, on the other hand, who was an especially close friend of Akbar, was a general, a statesman, and an organizer, and to his activity Akbar's kingdom chiefly owed the solidarity of its internal organization. Such was the quality of the circle that used to meet in the palaces of Fatehpur Sikri, buildings which still stand in the Indian sunlight, but empty now and desolate. Fatehpur Sikri, like the city of Ambar, is now a dead city. A few years ago, the child of a British official was killed by a panther in one of its silent streets. All this that we've quoted reveals a preeminent monarch. But Akbar, like all men, great or petty, lived within the limitations of his period and its circle of ideas. And a Turkoman ruling in India was necessarily ignorant of much that Europe had been painfully learning for 1,000 years. He knew nothing of the growth of a popular consciousness in Europe. and little or nothing of the wide educational possibilities that the Church had been working out in the West, his upbringing in Islam, and his native genius made it plain to him that a great nation in India could only be cemented by common ideas upon a religious basis, but the knowledge of how such a solidarity could be created and sustained by universal schools, cheap books, and a university system at once organized and free to think, to which the modern state is still feeling its way, was as impossible to him as a knowledge of steamboats or aeroplanes. The form of Islam he knew best was the narrow and fiercely intolerant form of the Turkish Sunnites. The Muslims were only a minority of the population. The problem he faced was indeed very parallel to the problem of Constantine the Great, but it had peculiar difficulties of its own. He never got beyond an attempt to adapt Islam to a wider appeal by substituting for "there is one God and Muhammad is his prophet" the declaration "there is one God and the emperor is his vice-regent." This, he thought, might form a common platform for every variety of faith in India, that kaleidoscope of religions. With this faith he associated a simple ritual borrowed from the Persian Zoroastrians, the Parsis, who still survived and survive today in India. This new state religion, however, died with him because it had no roots in the minds of the people about him. The essential factor in the organization of a living state, the world is coming to realize, is the organization of an education. This Akbar never understood, and he had no class of men available who would suggest such an idea to him or help him to carry it out. The Muslim teachers in India weren't so much teachers as conservators of an intense bigotry. They didn't want a common mind in India, but only a common intolerance in Islam. The Brahmins, who had the monopoly of teaching among the Hindus, had all the conceit and slackness of hereditary privilege. Yet though Akbar made no general educational scheme for India, he set up a number of Muslim and Hindu schools. He knew less, and he did more for India in these matters than the British who succeeded him. Some of the British viceroys have aped his magnificence, his costly tents and awnings, his palatial buildings, and his elephants of state, but none have gone far enough beyond the political outlook of this medieval Turkoman to attempt that popular education which is the absolute necessity to India before she can play her fitting part in the common weal of mankind. 5th F. A curious side result of these later Mongol perturbations, those of the 14th century of which Timurlane was the head and center, was the appearance of drifting batches of a strange refugee Eastern people in Europe, the Gypsies. They appeared somewhere about the end of the 14th and early 15th centuries in Greece, where they were believed to be Egyptians, hence Gypsy, a very general persuasion which they themselves accepted and disseminated. Their leaders, however, styled themselves Counts of Asia Minor. They'd probably been drifting about Western Asia for some centuries before the massacres of Timurlane drove them over the Hellespont. They may have been dislodged from their original homeland, as the Ottoman Turks were, by the great cataclysm of Genghis, or even earlier. They had drifted about as the Ottoman Turks had drifted about, but with less good fortune. They spread slowly westward across Europe, strange fragments of nomadism in a world of plough and city, driven off their ancient habitat of the Bactrian steppes, to harbour upon European commons, and by hedgerows, and in wild woodlands and neglected patches. The Germans called them Hungarians and Tartars, the French, Bohemians. They don't seem to have kept the true tradition of their origin, but they have a distinctive language which indicates their lost history. It contains many North Indian words, and is probably in its origin North Indian. There are also considerable Armenian and Persian elements in their speech. They are found in all European countries today. They are tinkers, peddlers, horse dealers, showmen, fortune tellers, and beggars. To many imaginative minds, their wayside encampments with their smoking fires, their rounded tents, their hobbled horses, and their brawl of sunburnt children have a very strong appeal. Civilization is so new a thing in history and has been, for most of the time, so very local a thing that it has still to conquer and assimilate most of our instincts to its needs. In most of us, irked by its conventions and complexities, there stirs the nomad strain. We are but half-hearted homekeepers. The blood in our veins was brewed on the steppes as well as on the ploughlands.